Almost every leader and organization invites people to speak up and make their voices heard. As we all know, that doesn't mean it happens in practice. In this episode, how leaders can set the tone for what's said and what's not. This is Coaching for Leaders, episode 672.
Produced by Innovate Learning, maximizing human potential.
Greetings to you from Orange County, California. This is Coaching for Leaders, and I'm your host, Dave Stachowiak. Leaders aren't born, they're made. And this weekly show helps you discover leadership wisdom through insightful conversations. A conversation that needs to happen in almost every workplace is a conversation where people speak up when they see something that is not working. It means that we need to speak up in our capacity as leaders. It means we also need to set the tone and the environment where others can speak up well too. Today, I'm so glad to welcome someone who has had so much experience doing this, learning this lesson, modeling this, and of course, doing it at the highest levels of performance. I'm so pleased to introduce Mike Massimino to you. He is a former NASA astronaut and a professor of mechanical engineering at Columbia University. He's also the senior advisor for space programs at the Intrepid Sea, Air, and Space Museum. He was selected as an astronaut by NASA in 1996 and is the veteran of two space flights, the fourth and fifth Hubble Space Telescope servicing missions in 2002 and 2009. Mike has a team record for the number of hours spacewalking in a single space shuttle mission and was also the first person to tweet from space. Mike has made numerous television appearances, including a six-time recurring role as himself on the CBS hit comedy The Big Bang Theory. He has also hosted Science Channel's The Planets and its special Great American Eclipse. He's featured in National Geographic Channel's series One Strange Rock and is the host for Science Channel's series The Planets and Beyond. He is a frequent guest on television news and talk show programs, including The Today Show, Good Morning America, and CNN. Mike is the author of the New York Times bestselling book Spaceman and now his newest book Moonshot, A NASA Astronaut's Guide to Achieving the Impossible. Mike, what a pleasure to have you on.
Pleasure to be here. Thanks for having me, Dave.
You have had so many wonderful accomplishments in your career, as so many astronauts have, and we're going to get into some of that, but I'd love to begin with a story from way back early in your career with NASA, where you took a flight with Jim Kelly in a T-38. And for those who don't know, the T-38 is the training aircraft that astronauts use to keep their skills sharp, but all astronauts, whether they're pilots or not, use the aircraft for training. You had a flight with Jim Kelly, and I was wondering if you could take us back to that day and what happened.
Sure, Dave. Yeah, so we were in the, I was new to all this, the culture and the way that we would operate at NASA, because I mean, even though I had experience working at the Space Center and working with NASA, I was not part of the astronaut office and I wasn't a military person. So the astronaut office was kind of, it was a mix of military and civilian people. And the culture was kind of, I think, the best things from the civilian world and the best things from the military world. And so operating in the airplane, though, when you're in a high-risk environment, just like we're operating in space, was more, I would say, the culture of flying in the military. It was kind of like the culture of being part of a squadron, a fighter squadron, let's say, which is where most of my colleagues who were, like you mentioned, Jim Kelly's nickname is Vegas, where Vegas came from. He was an Air Force pilot, for example, and had a lot of experience. And when we flew in these airplanes, we were briefed about the importance of checking everything, communicating, making sure everything is clear. And if you have a question, don't be afraid to ask. If you see something, it's your job to vocalize that. And these were things that were told to us, but the flight you're referring to kind of showed me how important it was to actually do those things and not just say, yeah, that's the way we're going to do it, but actually do it that way. And what happened was, it was an early training flight in my career. I probably had about 2 hours of flight time. Maybe this was maybe my third time going in the jet. And it was going to be a night flight with my friend Vegas. And we were flying over to San Antonio. And we were going to land during the day, just before the sun was going down. We're going to wait a little while until it got dark out and then come home, because Vegas wanted to get some nighttime. And so we flew out there, and Vegas is a great guy, a really good friend of mine now, even to this day. And we hit it off right away as we were in the same astronaut class, getting trained up. But he had like 8,000 hours of experience in the jet, flying all kinds of aircraft, combat experience. He was a test pilot. So he was really, really experienced, one of the best pilots in the country. And I had very little time. I had a private pilot's license, but I had very little time in a high-performance jet flying in that completely new environment. And we went out there and we were talking. He was telling me stories and I was learning stuff from him. And it was a really good flight on the way out. And on the way back, now it's dark. And I think, you know, when it gets dark out, just your situational awareness is a little bit less than it normally is. I think that's the case no matter what we're doing. When it becomes nighttime, we're driving a car or we're hiking or doing whatever, it just becomes a little different. It's harder to see, you lose a little bit of awareness. Anyway, we were getting ready to go and we were given a heading for departure. When you take off, you go to an altitude, you start climbing to an altitude, and at the same time, you turn in a direction. And they gave us a direction of, let's say, 180 on takeoff. So I put that in the flight computer while we were still on the ramp over by the FBO, the flight business office there that we were getting fueled up at. And then we get our clearance to go taxi to the runway. So we're taxiing to the runway. We get to the runway. We're still not clear for takeoff. And the flight controller comes over the communication line and says, all right, NASA 922, clear to climb to 15,000, turn heading 360 on takeoff, clear for takeoff. I repeat that back. My job was to handle the comm for this portion of the flight and the navigation. So I read that back and I put the new heading into the flight computer. He changed it on our taxi from base ops over to the runway. So Vegas lights the afterburner and we get to the right takeoff speed and he lifts the nose and we start flying and climbing. And then he starts turning in the direction of the old heading. And I'm seeing him do this and I don't say anything. And I realize he's going in the wrong direction, or so I think. I'm not sure. Maybe I heard wrong. What do I know? I'm the new guy. He's the great test pilot hero. And I just shut up and don't say anything. Well, after a couple moments of this, the flight controller comes over the communication and says, NASA 922, sharp right, turn now, heading 360. So Vegas grabs the airplane, you know, he's flying, but big abrupt move, you know, high G turn, getting into the right direction. The urgency of the controller was palpable. We could tell that he had something he was concerned about. And what had happened was, in that time between where we were at base ops and when we got to the runway, was that another airplane had arrived at the airfield. And so that's why he changed our direction, because that airplane was coming toward the field. We were leaving and the initial heading would have turned us right into him, which is what we were doing. We almost had a midair with this other airplane. So we avoided this midair because once the controller told us what was happening, Vegas made the turn. And then once we got on the right heading and things settled down a little bit, he goes, holy cow, what was that all about? He goes, did they change our heading on us? And I said, yes. And he goes, you knew that? And I go, yeah, it's right there in the flight computer. And he goes, you knew he changed the heading and you saw me going in the wrong direction and you didn't say anything? And I said something like, no, I thought you knew what you were doing. And that was the end of that conversation. There was no more, just what we needed to do to get back to Houston. We landed, we parked the airplane, we opened the cockpits, and I go down the ladder, put my feet on the ground, and my buddy is already on the ground waiting for me. You know, not like in my face, but very close to me and very serious. This very jovial, great friend of mine is now trying to make this a really important teaching lesson to a new guy. And he says, Mass, we almost got killed tonight because I went in the wrong direction. We almost had a midair, and that's on me. He goes, but we also almost got killed tonight because you didn't speak up, and that's on you. And you have to speak up, even if you're not sure. You need to speak up. It's better to speak up and be wrong than to stay silent and be sorry. And that was and he goes, you got it? You have to speak up. And I said, Vegas, I got it. And that was a lesson learned that I never forgot. And every other flight I had, if I saw something that was concerning, I would speak up. And sometimes, most of the time, you're just kind of checking, hey, I see this, what do you think? And you know, you're not always right, but it's always good to speak up. So that was the way we operated. And I think it was more on not just the new person or the new person speaking up, but it was more on the shoulders of the leadership to encourage that, not to be insulted when someone bring something up that maybe is correcting their action or something they missed. And you don't want people to keep silent because they're afraid to say anything.
Yeah, it's both sides, right? It's both the newcomer, the rookie, but it's also the person who's got the experience in setting the tone. And one of the things that you talk about in the book is the trigger of knowing when it's the time to speak up. And you had a bunch of experience with this, of course, in all the venues you've worked in and flown in. How do you know, like just as an individual, that as you, when you saw situations, especially learning from that situation, like how did you know it was the time to speak up? What was the trigger for you?
We used to talk about it sometimes in the airplane when you get that like sinking feeling in your stomach, or you just feel like this doesn't seem like a good idea, or you're uncomfortable. It was like a visceral feeling that you feel like, oh man, what is going on here? Or that just doesn't seem right to me. It could also be like just in your head, like that doesn't seem quite right. But usually like in a safety situation, what I found in the airplane, like at that time going in the wrong direction, I was like, you know, we're heading, it seems that we might be heading the wrong direction, which could be really bad. And when you have those thoughts, even if you're not really sure, it's important to speak up. When it was more like in the engineering side of things, which might be more applicable to our daily lives, that we're not necessarily under a threat of danger, of physical danger, but maybe you're working on a new product or figuring out how to go on a sales call or whatever it might be that you're doing at work and you're the new person. What I found was is just what I would notice as the new guy, especially if there was something that was done the same way over and over again, but they had trouble doing it, but it was just an accepted inefficiency. I would say, wait a minute, why, I would say to myself, why are they doing it that way? Is that really the only way to do it? And so an example of that was the installation of science instruments on the Hubble. In particular, this one type of instrument was the way it was described was an axial instrument because it went along the axis of the telescope, and they were the size of a refrigerator or a telephone booth. They're fairly large boxes, these instruments were. There were four of them in the telescope, and they had replaced them on previous missions. And on my first mission, I was going to be removing, me and my other spacewalker were being trained to remove it and put a new one in. And watching the tape and hearing the stories and listening to the training, they continually had trouble inserting these instruments. They can get the old one out, but the new one was really hard to align because you had to align it with a latch in the back. And once you put the instrument, you started putting it into the telescope, you couldn't see back there. So it was kind of trial and error. Like you put it in there, you drive a latch and then it didn't work and you put it back down. So there's a lot of hunt and peck, trial and error, back and forth. You have a lot of time to waste. Every minute counts on a spacewalk. Really almost every second counts. It's very important to try to be efficient when you're out there. And this thing could take a while doing this task. And I realized that the problem was you couldn't align it in the back, but I knew we could see in the front really well and that there was a lot of detail and data about how big these things were and how they would fit in the enclosure. So my idea was let's align it in the front with a new tool that I thought of and let's align it with this new tool in the front. And we know we'll be aligned in the back. And that was a pretty good idea, is what my colleagues told me. And we had a mock-up, a little proof of concept made, and we tried it. And then they had a higher fidelity version of it. And then we eventually built one, the team built one that we would use both in our training and on orbit. So we'd use this alignment tool. And on future flights, that's how, on my last flight, we used that same tool to align the instrument. So that was an idea that I put forward. And even though it was something that had been done before, they were very accepting of listening. Now, for that one, for an idea like that, I probably had 10 really bad ideas that I would voice. And they'd be like, yeah, no, you know, but it would use it as a teaching moment. But every once in a while, you get a good one. Same thing happened on my second flight when I was a leader. We were doing a gyroscope change out. And these gyroscopes are smaller instruments. They were about the size of a large shoebox, let's say. So that was about the size of the gyroscope. But it were a little finicky getting in. It was very, the way we had done it was really not efficient. But that's the way it had been done. It had been done in orbit twice. I trained to do it on a previous mission. I was going to do it on my final mission for real. And I knew how to do it. You know, I had already trained to do it on a previous flight. We had a new guy, Drew Feustel. I was like, this doesn't seem like a good way to do it. And he had an idea for a new tool based on a toy in his kid's toolbox, like a grabber tool to put the instrument in and take the old one out and put the new one in. And we listened to him, and that was a pretty good idea. We got a mock-up built and tried it, and we did it in training, and we built a unit for on orbit, and that's the way we did it on orbit. So sometimes it's important to speak up when there's ever a safety concern. You know, if you see something, say something. I ride the New York City subway, and they have these signs there. If you see something, say something. Something that might be suspicious, let somebody know. I think that when you see something like that, something suspicious, it's important to speak up. When you see something that might be a danger, wherever it might be, speak up. You know, driving in a car with your significant other, and you see something, and they may not. It's always better to voice it, I find, than to stay quiet. And the person has to appreciate that you're trying to help. And then when you have a new idea, sometimes it's the new person that sees something differently, and that input is important.
You write in the book, not only are the opinions of outsiders and rookies valid, outsiders and rookies are often the most observant people on the team. Tell me more about that.
I think that sometimes there's a human tendency to get accustomed to doing things a certain way, and that everything's going to be okay. And that was something I remember hearing early on as well, the importance of staying vigilant, always being vigilant about things. And that when you let your guard down and you might just accept things, you know, okay, this is just the way it is, that can be an issue. A new person comes in without any of that previous experience. And that previous experience is great. You know, it's very, very valuable, but maybe not as valuable, but also important is the new fresh perspective coming in. And I think that sometimes a new person just comes in there and is trying to learn, and their eyes are open, and they haven't been doing these things 1,000 times already. So when they get into a training session or into a meeting or into the airplane or whatever it might be, their antenna are up. You know, I noticed that we were going in the wrong direction, even though I was the new guy in the airplane. I'd made the mistake of not speaking up, but I noticed it. And the experienced guy with thousands of hours didn't. So, because I was on like this heightened awareness of what was happening around me. And I think that's something to realize, that as much as we try to stay vigilant, sometimes we just kind of fall into that state of, well, things are okay, it's always been like this, or you've had all these flights, or you have all this experience, and then something happens and you might not be expecting it. Whereas but the new person, yeah, they might be a little bit more attuned to what's going on. They don't have the experience, but I think the combination of a new person and an experienced person is good, because the experienced person can kind of guide where we're going here if something is brought up, and the inexperienced person is learning and may notice more than the person who has done it 1,000 times before.
There's another distinction you highlight in talking about this in your work, that it's one thing to speak up when you see something wrong. It's another thing to speak up when you do something wrong. And there's a culture around this in NASA. And you write in the book that whenever there was a close call, the job was of the person who was responsible for that to brief the astronaut office about it. And you write, the astronaut involved in the incident has to brief the entire astronaut office about it during our Monday morning meeting. It's like going to confession, only more embarrassing, because instead of talking to a priest anonymously in private, you are publicly admitting your mistake to your colleagues right out in the open. That's a high fear thing to be able to do. How did NASA and your colleagues get to a place where, despite that feeling of embarrassment, that people felt safe to actually bring issues out and talk about something they messed up on?
Well, if the penalty for, you know, for someone making a mistake, if you make a mistake, you make a mistake. But the penalty to everybody else, if you don't hear about it, is that you might repeat that mistake. And all kinds of crazy stuff can happen. And it can happen to very experienced people, particularly with the airplane. There's a lot of examples with the airplane, but also during spacewalks or working the robot arm, or during the flight, or during training. Whenever we had these close calls, or someone, because sometimes it wasn't, you know, things just happen, but sometimes it was the person's fault. But usually it's compounding things. No one wants to make mistakes. You know, we're well-trained, we're conscientious, but every once in a while, something is something happens for whatever reason, and you do something that you didn't want to do. But if it can happen to one person, it can happen to more than one. And if you survive that in what we call a close call, which means something happened, some mistake was made, or a malfunction happened, or something happened, and you're still alive to tell about it, you need to tell people about it, because the next time it might not turn out that way, that it might end up being something that could be harmful to someone. So that was the problem there, is that you didn't want people to not vocalize things, because then you could start repeating problems or put other people at risk. But the only way to do that was to make sure that if someone did come clean quickly and came forward with whatever happened in their close call, then there would not be penalties. It wouldn't be held against you. We would understand. And I heard this, and I was kind of, maybe at first I was a little skeptical, like, I don't know. But then I saw it happen pretty early on, and I talk about it in the book. There was an incident where a pilot was doing touch and goes, where you're coming back from a training flight, and you have some extra gas. So you do these practice landings, and then you take off right away again. You touch the runway and get the airplane reconfigured and light the afterburner and go back up there and do another practice landing. So he was doing a bunch of touch and goes, and he got a little bit too quick with the gear handle after he landed. So you land, and then you power up, and then you take off come off the runway, and you want to make sure you have at least two indications, like you have a vertical velocity, or your altitude is increasing, or something. Two indications with your instruments that you're actually climbing, and then you can get the gear. It's safe to get the gear. But what happened was he was a little bit too hasty, and he got the gear up a little bit too quickly, and the airplane settled back down to the runway, and he hit the runway at a high speed with a wingtip, and then was able to kind of wrestle the airplane off the ground and do that the next landing. But he did damage to the airplane, but he lived to talk about it, and he talked about it. He came at the next Monday morning meeting. He came clean and told us what happened, and he was forgiven. And, you know, the thought was, if this can happen to him, it can happen to anybody. There was another pilot who made a mistake and damaged an aircraft and tried to hide it and didn't fess up and was discovered because a mechanic was inspecting the airplane and saw what had happened. And because that pilot never came forward, that pilot was never forgiven and never flew in space again. So the penalties for not speaking up were major. The penalty for speaking up was I wouldn't say non-existent. I mean, depending on what you did, but I never saw anyone punished for speaking up. And these are some really like blatant dumb things that were done. Not necessarily that airplane guy, but other things that I saw. I was like, oh my goodness. But as long as you came clean, you know, the feeling is everyone's going to make mistakes. This can happen to anybody. As long as you come clean, you're going to be forgiven and you can be trusted. Because everyone makes mistakes. And that's the only way, I think, to enforce that. If you make it where, you know, you made this mistake, now you're gone, people are going to try to hide their mistakes. And that puts other people at risk. And we just couldn't afford that.
You said this earlier in the conversation, but I think it's such a key point. I'd love to come back to it. The power of two words. Thank you. Mm-hmm. And you highlight this at several points, talking about speaking up in your writing, that particularly in the cockpit, particularly in these high stress situations, that even if it's something that's like, okay, yeah, we know that the newcomer, the rookie says something, just the power of saying in that moment, thank you, it makes a big difference, doesn't it?
Yeah, it certainly does. And sometimes it's thank you because, hey, you saved the day. And also the other thing is more like, that's more common, is when you say thank you for something that maybe wasn't necessary, but shows that person is engaged. Mm. Again, early on in my training, there was an example given by one of our leaders of something that happened on the space station during some robotics operations. And everyone on the loop, on the crew and the control center who's involved with watching or looking, being involved with moving the robot arm at the time, can voice what we call an all stop. So if you see something that might seem out of the ordinary or concerning, anyone on that team could call all stop. And the person, the astronaut who's operating the robot arm in this example would stop what they were doing, put the brakes on and listen to what was going on. And so the example was that an all stop was called by someone on the ground, the control team. that was voice to the crew, all stop, you know, nothing, you don't need a, like an explanation, or at first the explanation comes later. What you hear is all stop. And the crew member stopped and they voiced what the problem was. They thought they saw something on a camera or something was in the way. And the crew member, who was an experienced crew member, said, yes, I see that. Thank you for saying that, for seeing that and calling it. But I see this, this, and this. And that's why I think that that was okay. But I'm seeing this data over here. So I think I'm in the clear. Do you agree? And then the ground looked at it and goes, yes, you know, we can agree. You can continue. He says, he goes, thank you. And then what he finished with is, okay, I see, blah, blah, blah. I'm going to do this. And thank you again for calling the all stop. So even though it interrupted what this guy was doing, was kind of saying you're doing something that could create a problem, when he wasn't, he didn't take any offense to that. In fact, he was grateful that the flight controller called the all stop, because it showed that they were paying attention and they were involved. And maybe next time when they called the all stop, it was for something that really needed an all stop call. But I remember that. And that was brought up in one of our meetings as an example of how to operate. And as astronauts, we were commander or the leader of something officially, but we always were kind of in a position where we were sort of the leader of almost everything we were doing in certain ways, because people looked up to the astronauts. And I think people in a lot of work environments, people look up to the leaders or the manager or the person that has the experience or the legend at work, whoever it might be, and they'll listen to us, and we want them to come forward. And the reason that it was one of our leaders telling all of the astronauts that this is the way you should operate was that even if you were the new guy and you were doing something like this, operating like this on the robot arm, that this is the way you do it. Because even though you might be the new guy, the people on the ground, on the control team, the instructors, they're going to look up to you. You're the astronaut. You're at the tip of the spear. They're going to listen to what you have to say. And so for you to set a good example, this is how you do it. This is how we operate. And so that message was for everybody in the office, that when you're in that position, you know, where you can say, you know, where you could say something negative, oh, leave me alone, I was fine, why'd you do that? That's not the right answer. The right answer here is to be a good leader. And we don't know, even if you're not in, I'm the official commander of things, but you might be the person that everyone's looking up to or counting on and will listen to. When that's a powerful position to be in. You can move things one way or the other. You can define the culture or influence the culture. And that was the message there, that even if you're an inexperienced astronaut, you have the ability to influence how people are gonna operate. And this is the way to do it. When someone points something out and they're incorrect, you still say thank you and make sure that they know you appreciate them putting their time and their attention to helping you.
It's interesting how often I think we underestimate in leadership roles how much other people are paying attention, and especially to us and what we're doing or not doing, and especially in a role as visible as astronaut, right? Like you said, you could be the new first day on the job, but because of the role and the title and the power that comes with that, as so many folks in our audience have in their roles, it really does change how you respond. One, the culture overall, but in the moment when things happen, like having that discipline to say thank you in the moment makes a really big difference. And you mentioned Drew Feustel a bit ago and him coming in as the new person on the Hubble for the second flight that you were on and looking at something and saying, hey, I've got a better way to do this. And ultimately that prevailed as like a great way to go forward, right? But initially, I'm curious, do you recall what you and some of your veteran colleagues, like how you responded to him at that time to encourage, like, I think initially there was a little bit of skepticism there, but like what you did so that information actually came out?
Well, before I knew Drew, there's a saying, you never have a second chance to make a first impression. So you always want to try to make a good first impression.
Yeah.
But a lot of times we don't get off on the right foot, or we have a different impression than what reality is. And when I first met Drew, I mean, I think other people really liked him. And when I first met him, you know, he seemed like a nice guy. But we were going to do a training exercise together. And I was more the person who would over prepare for things. And he was a little bit looser than I was. And so he was a new guy. And this is before we were assigned to a flight together. And when I went, when I had one of my first training runs in the pool, this is a spacewalking training run. The mentor I had was my friend Steve Smith, and I wanted to learn as much as I could. And I think I was a bit nervous about it and wanted to make a good impression. And Steve was a friend of mine, and so he helped me. We went and did some extra work out at the pool and prepared and talked about it. And so I kind of used that as the model of how you get a new guy ready to spacewalk, because that's how Steve did it with me, because that's the way I wanted to do it. And Steve complied. And when Drew and I were assigned to do this, and now I was the experienced guy, and I said, hey, do you want to get together and go out to the pool and do this stuff or get there early and do this extra prep? And he's like, yeah, no, I'm okay. Don't worry about it. It's like, really? And he's like, yeah, don't worry about it. I remember I showed up early and he wasn't there, you know, just in case he changed his mind. He showed up right on time. And I was like, well, we'll see how this goes. It was like the best training run I've ever seen anyone have at the, in one, for one of their first training runs. Huh. He was just a natural, and he prepared differently than I did. But my first impression was he doesn't care as much as I care, but he did. He cared just as much as I did. And as I got to know him, he became and still is one of my best friends. I talked to him usually about once a week about whatever was going on. He just recently left the astronaut office. He went on to fly a couple more times after that first flight he had with me, and went on to become the chief of the astronaut office. He was the boss of all the astronauts, and now just recently left and retired from NASA. So if you would have told me that this guy would end up being one of my five best friends in my life when I first met him, I'd be like, nah, I don't think so. But that's what happened. He really is a dear friend of mine, and I love the guy, and I didn't have that great first impression. And there was another thing I write about in the book, I think somewhat related to this, was that if you meet someone at work or someone on your team, and you know they're there for a reason. They were picked, selected, earned that position for a reason. We might not know what that reason is yet, but when you first meet them. But if you meet someone and you don't hit it off or you don't like them, don't think of it as you don't like them. Think of it as you don't know them well enough. And take that time to not jump at that first conclusion, that first impression, if it's a negative one.
You've written a couple of best-selling books. You've had your work out there. You're on the media all the time and sharing lessons about work as an astronaut. I'm curious, like, if you reflect on the last year or two of, and especially getting this new book out, you know, leaders are learning, growing, as you talk about a lot in the book. Sometimes they're changing their minds. When you reflect on the last year or so, what's one thing you've changed your mind on?
I think one thing is, a couple things. One is that when I first leaving NASA, which I talk about as well, was somewhat traumatic. You know, here I was, wanted to be an astronaut since I was a little boy, and I made it, and I was there. It ended up being for 18 years, but I felt like, we talked about like your instinct and what your gut is telling you, and I felt like it was time to go. And but there's always some regret involved with that, you know, oh, that I make a mistake. I think a couple things have happened in the last couple of years. I realized that I never really left the space program. I don't work for NASA anymore. They don't pay me anymore. But of course, I'm once an astronaut, always an astronaut. And what we're talking about now is space experiences. I teach at Columbia. My class yesterday, I talked about space travel. When I go on the news, I'm usually talking about space travel. I also talk about, I mean, lessons in different ways. So I think what I've learned in the last couple of years is that I don't have to be an astronaut to contribute to the space program or to have a happy life. I don't know if that makes any sense, because I'm able to use those experiences and share them in a way that is very meaningful to me, and maybe even more helpful to the greater good than me serving on a flight crew like I used to do, because that was very directed. But to take those experiences and now be able to share those lessons with others, I found that to be very gratifying. So maybe that's what I think I've learned in the last couple of years, that things have turned out okay.
Mike Massimino is the author of Moonshot, A NASA Astronaut's Guide to Achieving the Impossible. Mike, thank you so much for your work and for sharing it with all of us.
Dave, thanks for having me. And to all those listening, thanks for listening. I really appreciate it. Thank you.
If this conversation was helpful to you, a few related episodes I'd recommend. One of them is episode 433, The Way to Start Managing Up with Tom Henschel. Tom, the host of the Look and Sound of Leadership podcast, has been on the show dozens of times over the years. And in that conversation, we looked at one of the people specifically in the relationships many of us do want to speak up to, at least occasionally, the next level manager. How do we do that effectively, politically, and also with some savvy? Tom and I walk through step by step what are some things to think about, not only the tactics, but perhaps more importantly, the mindset of doing that well. Episode 433 for that. I'd also recommend episode 546, How to Speak Up with Consen Locke. Consen's book, Making Your Voice Heard, is the number one recommendation I have for folks who reach out to me and say, I'd like to get better at speaking up. What do I need to be thinking about and doing? How do I actually do that in practice? Consen is a great resource for that. You'll find some of the details of our conversation in episode 546. And of course, her book is a great follow-up to that. And then finally, I also recommend episode 597, How to Help People Speak Truth to Power. Megan Raitz was my guest on that episode, and we looked at it from the other side. If you're the person who's in the leadership role, what are the things that you can do to make it easy, or at least easier, for people to speak up to you? And looking at some of her research and practice on how to do that well, episode 597. All of those episodes, a good complement to this conversation with Mike. And of course, you can find them all on the coachingforleaders.com website. I'm inviting you today to set up your free membership at coachingforleaders.com, because it's going to give you access to the entire episode library of episodes I've aired since 2011, and you can search by topic for exactly what you're looking for. This episode is going to be filed under organizational culture, personal leadership, and influence. Dozens and dozens of other episodes we've aired over the years under all of those topics, plus many, many more. It's one of the benefits inside of free membership, in addition to full access to my library. I am databasing just about everything I find that I think will be helpful to you. Other podcast episodes I find on the internet, resources and articles from The Wall Street Journal, The New York Times, Forbes, so many of the industry publications. Whenever I find something online that I think will be helpful, I do pass along those in the weekly guide each week, but I'm also databasing those, and I'm adding to that database regularly. It's all freely available to you inside of Dave's library. One of the benefits inside of the free membership. To access it, just go to coachingforleaders.com and set up your free membership, and you can begin exploring around there inside all of those benefits. And if you've had your free membership for a bit, I'm inviting you to find out about Coaching for Leaders Plus. One of the benefits that I'm providing each week for our members of Coaching for Leaders Plus is my weekly journal entry. I'm writing an entry with a response to a question from one of our members, or a topic that I've been hearing about that I think will be helpful, or a reflection on one of the recent episodes. This past week, one of our members asked me, how do you kickstart development for a team when they're overextended? How do you actually support professional development when there's no margin, there's no budget? Maybe there was a development program at some point, but for whatever reason, it's just not funded, not available right now. Where do you start? How do you begin? I answered that question in detail in my most recent journal entry. And if you'd like to get not only that one, but access to all the new journal entries each week, it comes to you on email. It's one of the benefits inside of Coaching for Leaders Plus. You can find details by going over to coachingforleaders.plus. Coaching for Leaders is edited this week, as it always is, by Andrew Croker. Production support is provided by Sierra Priest. Next Monday, I'm glad to welcome Mike Caulfield to the show. He is going to be walking us through how to prevent being duped. So much more. We're seeing things online that aren't true, are misleading. There's so much advertising. There's so much sponsorship on the open web. How do we actually sift through it and find out what's true? So when we are looking for information to support our work, to support our clients, to support our employees, that we know we're finding the best information. Mike's going to walk us through a process for how to consider that next week. Join me for that conversation, and see you back on Monday.